University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum features Penny Gold, professor of history at Knox College, Galesburg, Illinois. Her lecture presentation is entitled, A Jewish Feminist Studies Christian Monasticism. Gold is the author of the book, The Lady and the Virgin, Image, Attitude, and Experience in 12th Century France. She is a member of the Association for Jewish Studies, the National Women's Studies Association, and the Society for Values in Higher Education. She received her bachelor's degree in history from the University of Chicago and did graduate work at Stanford University, receiving her Ph.D. in medieval studies.
Today at Forum, we recognize and celebrate the role of women in history. Throughout the United States, this week is Women's History Week. Governor Orr has proclaimed the month Women's History Month. Women's History Week is always celebrated in the week in which March 8th falls, for since 1909, March 8th has been International Women's Day. We have the honor today to have as our speaker Dr. Penny Gold. Dr. Gold is a leading medieval historian, well known for her book, The Lady and the Virgin. The title is based on the two key images of women in the 12th century, the secular lady of love literature and the religious image of the Virgin Mary. In her book, she examines these images in comparison with the real lives of virgins and ladies, of monasticism and property relations, and the images and experiences of men. The result is a brilliant analysis of both men and women, whether they be two lovers in a romance, the virgin and her son, the nuns and the monks, or husband and wife in a property transfer. Penny Gold received her BA degree, cum laude, from the University of Chicago, her master's degree in history from Stanford University, and her PhD in medieval studies from Stanford. She is associate professor of history at Knox College, which is a fine liberal arts college in Galesburg, Illinois, where she is also chair of the faculty. In recent years, she has been rethinking her scholarly interests. She will be sharing these thoughts with us today. Will you join me in welcoming Dr. Penny Gold?
Thank you very much, Elaine. It's a great pleasure to be here and to visit another school, another liberal arts college in a neighboring state. It's interesting to listen to Elaine's introduction of me in the context of what I'll be talking about today, because the substance of my talk is to tell you how I've been moving from being a medieval historian, which was my personal professional identity for many years, to something else and the kind of journey that I'm on in my work. So the talk today is an autobiographical exploration of the development of my professional interests and of the personal motivations that have influenced the professional choices I've made. More specifically, I will be describing the process through which I came to understand how my identity as both a Jew and as a feminist influenced my original choice of medieval history as a subject of study, with Christian monasticism as a particular focus and interest. So while I will describe some of the substance of my research along the way, this talk is really more about why I've done the research I have done. I will be leaving time for questions at the end of the talk, so if you have questions either about the talk itself and my personal journey or about the substance of the research, I'll be happy to answer those at the end. The goals of my talk today are really threefold. One, to provide you with an individual story, my own, which I hope is interesting for its own sake. Secondly, to provide a model for looking for personal concerns in academic work, which you may not be used to. And I hope that this will help you think critically about scholarly work that you come across in your studies, so that if I give you a model about what was in my not in my mind so much, but in my heart as I did my scholarly work, that you can try and figure that out for scholarly work that you read yourself. And finally, to provide a model of self-examination, because I think such examination can yield interesting discoveries about oneself. For me, the process of discovery began as a result of a research project I undertook several years ago on contemporary rather than medieval monasticism. Until that time, my research had focused exclusively on the European Middle Ages, a period from about 500 to 1500, with my research essentially in the 12th century. Now, one of the central concerns of this medieval research had been the role of gender in religious ideology and practice. Medieval Catholic ideology, and in fact contemporary Catholic ideology as well, incorporates an ambivalence between the difference between men and women and the equality between men and women. There is, at the same time, a focus on difference between men and women, which you can see, for example, in the exclusion of women from the Catholic priesthood. Why would women be excluded? Well, they're in some way different from men and inferior to men, and so need to be excluded. On the other hand, there is within Catholicism also an emphasis on the spiritual equality of men and women, and you can see that focus illustrated in the institution of monasticism. While the priesthood as an institution excludes women, monasticism is specifically an institution that is open to women and in which women have a very equivalent role to men, the nun and the monk. So monastic life, I thought, provided a rich arena for exploring the playing out of the ambivalence within Christianity, because although monastic communities themselves are an example of the potential of an autonomous spiritual life for women, it was yet the case that, in fact, female communities relied on men in various ways, particularly for priestly services and material assistance. In my work as a medieval historian, I completed a study of the varieties of ways in which female communities made arrangements with men to have these services provided, and that's one chapter in my book, The Lady and the Virgin. But I was left with some questions that could not be answered because of limited documentation available for these medieval institutions. That is, these documents were for the most part written by men and so excluded the direct perspective of women themselves. And also, even the documents that existed were very narrow in range, basically providing incidental information about the relations between women and men rather than focusing centrally on them. I think I still found out a lot of interesting things, but I was left with a lot of questions. In particular, I had been unable to discover very much about what considerations were involved in the formulation of different arrangements made with men by different communities, or about how women and men felt about these arrangements. Then a number of years ago, I happened to visit a modern women's community, which had in fact been founded in cooperation with nearby monks, and with whom the nuns had an ongoing relationship. And it occurred to me then that I might be able to answer for these two modern communities, this women's community that had been founded with the help of a nearby men's community, that for these communities I might be able to answer questions that had gone unanswered for the medieval communities. Now, although I understood from the beginning that there are important differences between modern and medieval monastic communities, in fact, the communities that I came to know lived by a very strict contemplative lifestyle that had really a great deal in common with the medieval monastic life, and in fact was based very directly on a medieval monastic rule. So when I began to study these modern monastic communities, my initial conscious motivation in pursuing research on these two communities was solely an academic motivation. That is, I wanted to pursue any insight this new study might give me into the motivations that were working in a medieval setting. And even if I found that the modern motivations were fundamentally different from what might pertain in medieval institutions, I would at least have satisfied my curiosity for this one case as to why men might be willing to invest so much time and money in the support of a women's community, and what such support meant personally and emotionally for both the men and women involved in that effort. My research on these two communities then centered on the relationship between the communities of nuns and monks. And I'll, for the sake of talking about them, use pseudonyms for the communities of St. Mary's Abbey for the women's community and St. John's Abbey for the men's. The men's community, St. John's, is the older of the two and was founded in the mid-19th century. St. Mary's was founded only recently in the 1960s under the sponsorship of St. John's, which was about 20 miles away from where the women's community ended up being placed. St. Mary's was an offshoot of another women's community that was about 1,000 miles away, actually on the East Coast, whereas these two communities are in the Midwest. That community on the East Coast is called the Mother House, the house from which the Daughter House came. All three communities, Mother House, Daughter House, and the sponsoring community of St. John's, belong to the same contemplative monastic order, which traces its roots back to the rule of St. Benedict. As contemplatives, their lives are centered on prayer, organized, and their life is organized around seven periods of communal prayer during the day, also periods of work and leisure activity. This life of prayer is fostered with the help of something called enclosure, which means that nuns and monks must stay within the limits of their communities, of their monasteries, very physically within the community, with some exceptions. Their life as contemplatives thus contrasts significantly to that of active monastic orders, which are, if you're familiar with monastic orders, you probably know active ones. These are communities in which the mission of the monastery is service to others, for example, in the form of schools or hospitals, and that mission then necessitates much more contact with the outside world than is true for contemplative monks and nuns. Now, St. John's sponsorship of St. Mary's entailed a large financial contribution to the new foundation, about $100,000, and this was in the 1960s, as well as an ongoing commitment of personnel. Arrangements were made to have two monks of St. John's live at St. Mary's, one serving as chaplain to the nuns and so providing that priestly service that was necessary, and the other as farm boss, because the nuns had a big farm but didn't know how to farm it themselves, and so the monks provided a man who had a great deal of experience in farming. The questions I pursued in my research on the foundation of St. Mary's were questions like, what exactly was the monk's contribution to the planning of the new foundation, and how was the planning coordinated between the monks at St. John's and that mother house that was far away, but from whom the nuns came? Why was the community of St. John's interested in and willing to make such a substantial commitment to a women's community? And I was also interested in the ongoing relationship between the communities as it had developed over the 20 years of St. Mary's existence. And these are questions that I'm not going to answer for you here, but that if you want to ask me about, I'll be happy to talk about. Now, in order to answer those questions, I needed to do two kinds of research. I needed to do archival research, which is standard for historians, looking at the records of the monasteries, the letter correspondence that went back and forth between St. John's and the Mother House. But I also wanted to do interviewing, fairly extensive interviewing, both with the people who were involved in the foundation, some of whom were still alive, and also with the nuns and monks who were part of the ongoing life of the community to get at this notion of what was the ongoing relationship between the nuns and the monks. Now, as a medieval historian, I wasn't very prepared to do interviewing of live subjects. It's very convenient, really, dealing with dead people. You don't have to worry about offending them. You don't have to worry about interfering in their lives. And that's not true if you're either an oral historian or, say, a sociologist, an anthropologist. And I took very seriously the responsibility on my part to do this interviewing in a responsible manner. I was particularly concerned about the effect that my research might have on the communities themselves, because I would be discussing with the members of the community issues that were, in fact, controversial to them in terms of the foundation of the community and how that happened, and also particularly the ongoing relationship between monks and nuns in the order and in these two communities. So to help me figure out how I should carry out responsible interviewing, I did some reading, in particularly in anthropological literature, literature that talks about field work and anthropologists' involvement in their field work. My reading reassured me that I had, in fact, taken appropriate steps to minimize potential problems. I had informed the communities, potential problems, that is, in terms of my influence on the communities. I had informed the communities fully and honestly about my research plans, so their permission to have the research done was an informed one. In fact, they were eager for me to do the research, partly because this order was in the process of itself trying to determine the appropriate relationship between monks and nuns at the level of official governance. And one nun even referred to my doing this research as providential. That is, she considered that I had been sent by God to do this study of the relationship between men and women in their order because it was indeed a concern of theirs at the time. So I was reassured on this end. But the reading informed me of a potential problem that had not occurred to me, and that was the effects of field research on the researcher. Okay, what would happen to me? The face-to-face encounter with customs and values different from one's own can initiate personal change, even crisis, in the researcher. This is what I found out from my reading. Self-understanding on the part of the researcher, both of motivations and of possible effects of the research situation, is thus recommended as useful preparation for the field. This made me realize that my involvement in this research might indeed be unsettling to me because, like an anthropologist, or like most anthropologists, I would be going into a setting that was very different from my own daily life, into a monastery where I, on the other hand, am married and live within a secular community, into a Christian community where I'm Jewish, and so that I needed to think about ahead of time what that unsettling process might be like and why was I doing what I was doing, so that thinking through my motivations for doing the research might help me deal with that process of unsettlement as I did the research itself. The problems in general of doing field research often stem from the researcher's ambiguous role as both friend and stranger to the community being studied. Some degree of friendship and of trust is integral to such a study because you can get information only to the extent that you develop rapport with the people whom you're studying. And on the other hand, you can make sense of your research only if you are enough of a stranger to step back and view the people as objects of study, which is something you don't usually do to your friends. Now, although I did not plan to do the intensive kind of participant observation and actually living in the communities that's typical of most ethnographic or anthropological research, yet I found myself caught in this dichotomy of friend and stranger and thought it would have an impact even just on doing the series of interviews that I was planning. I was a friend both to specific individuals within the communities who I had come to know over a period of years and also somehow to the communities as a whole. I was considered a friend of the communities as a whole. Yet I was also a stranger to my subjects, something that was conveniently summarized in a letter of recommendation that one of the nuns wrote for me when I was applying for a grant to fund this research. In explaining why I was the right person to do this study, Sister Elizabeth said about me, "She is very objective in her observations and lacking in bias or prejudice as regards monasticism in the Roman Catholic religion, despite her own background, which is Jewish. She has a deep appreciation of the ability of men and women to collaborate and is not overly biased as a feminist." I didn't get this grant. I don't know whether it was because of her letter or not. What I saw in her comments, besides the generous compliment which she did give about my research capability, was her identification of the ways in which I was a stranger to the community, identities which Sister Elizabeth saw as having to be overcome in order for me to be, quote, objective about the communities. And the two identities that she saw as needing to be overcome were my identity as a Jew and my identity as a feminist. And these are also ways in which I was a stranger to the community. Now, the feminist strangeness to the community, I actually see as the less problematic of the two. Sister Elizabeth juxtaposed my feminism to, quote, my deep appreciation of the ability of men and women to collaborate. Her juxtaposition probably was based on her limited familiarity with feminism, and with an assumption that feminists are hostile to interaction with men. But it was, in fact, my observation of the active collaboration between men and women in the monastery, a collaboration that appeared joyful and profound, that interested me in studying these communities, exactly because I was not used to such institutionalized collaboration in secular life. Now, I would wish that this monastic collaboration was not based to the extent that it is on the disability of women to be priests, and that thus hence having to collaborate with a priest who lived in the community, or on the nuns' ignorance of farming technology, which meant that they had to collaborate with the man who was the farm boss. But given those conditions, I was still interested in the nature of the relationships that worked out. I saw ways in which there might be parallels between monks and nuns and men and women in other professional settings, the academic community indeed. Professional people also have to develop working relationships, but do not have rules of enclosure and celibacy or commitment to sexual abstinence to guide them. And they also, in most cases, lack the strong commitment to a common ideal and way of life that helps to unify these contemplative monastics. That is, you all out here may be somehow committed to Nebraska Wesleyan University, but it's not the same kind of commitment that these nuns and monks have to Jesus Christ or that they have to their particular monastic order. And it is that common commitment in the particular case of this study to their particular way of life within their order that I think allowed for and enabled the kind of collaboration that they achieved. So I think that my feminism and my life as a female professional in fact brought me closer to an identification with the community rather than farther away from it. And I saw the relationship between my feminism and this research as a direct and self-conscious one connected to a decision that I made early in graduate school that I wanted to unify my personal life and my professional life. And since my personal life was at that time preoccupied with my situation as a woman and with efforts to change the kinds of relationships that I had with both women and men, the connection I made with my research was to study women in history and also the relations between women and men in history, and that's something I carried through to into the book as Elaine described it. Now, what about the Jewish part of my identity and what that had to do with this study? I think that is more difficult. It certainly was more difficult for me to figure out. I feel very much at home in the nuns' community when I visit there. I'm drawn to the common way of life, the committed pursuit of ideals, the female environment, the silence, because one of the rules of contemplative life is that you can't talk all the time, which may seem strange that an academic would like that, but can be very nice. And the easy communication on a deeper level than I'm used to in everyday life. But I am a Jew, and they are Christians, and their Christian identity is to them by far the most important aspect of their existence. I had to consider, to what extent was I drawn to them because of, rather than despite, their Christianity? To what extent might part of their interest in me have been as a potential convert? And I think this is not a major factor, but Sister Elizabeth, the one with whom I was, most close, would give me books, you know, that talked about Jews who converted to Christianity, give me these autobiographies of them, and you know, once asked me directly what I felt about Jesus. And then when I just told her, very frankly, nothing, she didn't pursue that anymore. The issue of conversion became real to me a few years ago when a Jewish friend who began studying active orders of nuns about the same time I began studying these contemplative communities, she converted to Catholicism. She was sure then that her choice of research topic was an unconscious way of bringing her personally closer to Catholicism. I did not feel that was the case for me, but I was disturbed enough by her conversion to lose my enthusiasm for the research for a while. Now, to identify further what being Jewish might have to do with my choice of research, I need to describe briefly my background as a Jew in America. I am the grandchild of Russian Jewish immigrants, and my parents, while very concerned to assimilate to American culture, were also committed to bringing up their children as Jews. And they participated in a social world that was almost entirely Jewish. I grew up in an urban environment on the East Coast, an area in which Christians were clearly the majority, but in which Jews had a strong minority presence, and there was a general awareness among Christians about Jewish existence and even about the basics of Jewish life, which is not the case in the Midwest, for example. As a child, I had sufficient institutional connections with Judaism through synagogue, through Hebrew classes, through Sunday school, through Jewish summer camp, to make me identify in concrete ways as a Jew on a daily or nearly daily basis. I grew up with a strong feeling of being different from others. This feeling sometimes caused discomfort, feeling excluded from majority beliefs and activities, like Christmas, which you can't avoid in America. And yet, on the other hand, this feeling of difference also gave me a sense of value, of belonging to a special group that had its own identity within which I developed my own sense of self. This feeling of difference became submerged when I went to college, where I was in an environment, the University of Chicago, in which Jews were numerous, visible, and valued, but where I also no longer maintained any institutional connections to Judaism. I stopped going to synagogue, I didn't go to summer camp anymore, I didn't go to Hebrew school. And in graduate school, the feeling of difference was less acute for other reasons. There at Stanford, I was in an environment, as in the Midwest, in which Jews were such a tiny minority that my Jewishness became more of an oddity, occasionally mentioned, rather than a daily identity. And it did, in fact, seem to become irrelevant in some sense that I was Jewish. I now think that the inner experience of feeling different, even though it was submerged in these years in college and graduate school, in fact contributed to my choice of studying medieval history. And this is what I only became aware of as I began this process of thinking through, trying to go back, why is it that I'm drawn to the study of monasticism? Okay, so now I'm considering why I was drawn to medieval history, which was something I discovered in my senior year of college. What intrigued me consciously were the differences between medieval culture and my own. That is, I did not become the kind of medievalist who studies the Magna Carta as the source of modern constitutionalism, somebody that takes the approach of the Middle Ages of here are the germs, the roots of certain modern phenomena. That approach is certainly valid, but somehow personally I just always found that boring. It was not something I was drawn to in any way. I was interested and drawn to what's different about the Middle Ages and studying that as a culture that is as different as you can get within the Western tradition from modern culture. Now, I always thought of this appeal of difference in terms of things like generally the contrast between medieval and modern social structures and intellectual habits, things like the predominance of rural life, the development of systems of law and politics in the Middle Ages based on memory rather than on written record, the prevalence of religious belief. But my new research made me consider that an essential part of the otherness that I reacted to and was drawn to in the Middle Ages was its Christianity. This seems so obvious, but I had missed it before. I also realized, as I thought back, that in my years as a medievalist, I had read virtually nothing on medieval Judaism. And this avoidance goes back to my graduate work, because at Stanford there was one of the two medieval professors in the history department was somebody whose major work was on medieval antisemitism, and yet I never studied that subject with him. This avoidance continued in my teaching. When some years ago I proposed a course at Knox on medieval religion, my original proposal had in it that I was going to do Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, all three very important religions in the Middle Ages. And yet when I came to teach the course, I only included Christianity. Now, this was not out of complete disinterest in knowing more about Jewish life, because, in fact, most of my leisure reading was about Jewish life, particularly contemporary Jewish life. I seemed committed, however, not to studying Jews. My first explanation as I thought about this was that I did not want to make my own group an object of study. The possible negative results of this are illustrated by the experience of a sociologist named Samuel Heilman, who's an Orthodox Jew who did research on his own congregation, and in the process ended up distancing himself from that community. Because, again, it's difficult to study friends. It's difficult to study somebody and yet maintain them in close contact with yourself. Perhaps also involved was my identification with the role of an outsider. That is, as a Jew studying Christians, I was an outsider studying the majority group. Hannah Arendt, a prominent philosopher and Jewish herself, has said that Jews in the modern world have had to choose between being either a pariah or a parvenu. Either you're an outsider, that is a pariah, as a Jew outside the main group, or you are a parvenu trying to make it on the inside. I think that in my own life, I have participated in both of these roles, although I like to think I'm more comfortable being a pariah, the outsider, different. Being a medievalist may in some way be related to this. For example, when I'm introduced to somebody and they ask what I do, I usually say I'm historian. If they insist on pursuing it and say what kind of history, if I answer medieval history, the reaction is almost always one of perplexity and distancing. The conversation rarely goes further, and there is something in me that has enjoyed that astonished response. But much as I hate to admit it, the more I thought about it, the more my studying Christians qualified me as a parvenu rather than as a pariah. If I tried to imagine myself as a scholar of Judaism, something that would bring my Jewishness into the public domain of my classroom and my profession, as opposed to reading novels and biographies in my living room, I thought, no, I would be uneasy being so publicly identified with Jews. As a medievalist, I might be marginalized among historians, but if, for example, I chose to study medieval Judaism, I would be marginalized even among medievalists. But I said to myself, I am marginalized within the profession as a feminist and a scholar of women's history. Why was that all right? Why was that margin comfortable to me, but not being marginalized as a Jew? One effect of marginalization is that you land in the company of other people similarly on the margin. For me, the association with other women's studies scholars has been a continuing joy and a benefit to my research and my life. What was painful to admit was that I could feel that I would be less comfortable with a similar public professional association with Jews. So what did I learn from this self-examination? I think I learned that first, my Jewishness and my feminism both contributed to my identity as someone outside of the majority culture, but that I was more comfortable in the feminist margin than I was in the Jewish one. I learned that my choice of medieval history may have been connected to my comfort with the role of outsider. And I learned that my choice of studying Christians, both in the medieval world and in contemporary monastic communities, while it might have been connected with my comfort in the role of the outsider, was more likely connected to a desire to associate myself, in fact, with majority culture and to disassociate myself with a public identity as a Jew. Now, historians are continually engaged in the discovery of hidden motivations for people who live in the past. But they are usually reluctant to turn this X-ray vision on themselves. I'm certain that everyone's choice of research area has strong connections to personal motivations, but what these are may be difficult to identify. In my own case, as I've come to understand it, I see a conflict between an attraction to identification, a direct identification with my subject as illustrated in my ongoing focus on women, and yet an attraction to differentiation from my subject as illustrated in my choice of medieval culture and Christianity. Historians tend to be suspicious of people who study their own, worrying about problems of objectivity. But even when no direct identification with one subject is readily apparent, as for my study of Christianity, I could not be accused of the usual kind of bias of, say, a Catholic historian studying the Inquisition in the Middle Ages, for example, or of a Protestant historian studying Luther. I could not be accused of that obvious kind of personal interest. But even when no direct identification with one subject is readily apparent, a position of difference implies a definition of self from which the subject is other. And since these motivations have an effect on what we see in our research data, it's important for the sake of our research, as well as for our own self-knowledge, to consider what connections there are between our personal lives and our professional choices. For myself, this exploration led to a new understanding of the role being Jewish has had in my professional interests. Now, the process of discovery that I've described began in 1983. The understanding I came to of myself was unsettling. Once I understood my ambivalence towards being Jewish and studying Jewish subjects, I could no longer continue in the same path of research. To do so would have been an act of avoidance rather than the earlier unconsciousness of underlying motivation. In fact, without making a conscious choice to abandon my research in the Middle Ages and Christianity in general, I slowly found myself less and less interested in these subjects, no longer able to approach them with the same emotional investment. It's kind of like I told you before that the Magna Carta is the source of modern constitutionalism. That origins approach has always been just not interesting to me. So too, now something which had been the central part of my life for some 15 years, I was no longer finding interesting. Journals I've subscribed to were going left, piled up and unread. I would go into an academic bookstore and I would have to drag myself to the medieval history section that I would have to see what new books were on the shelves, but I didn't naturally go in that direction. And my thoughts about new courses began drifting towards comparative religion and then towards Jewish history. I think what happened here is similar to one of the principles of psychoanalytic theory, that once you understand the unconscious roots of a particular symptom, the symptom itself disappears. So a psychoanalytic treatment, for example, of fear of being closed up in an elevator would be to explore your unconscious, what unconscious history there may be in your childhood that gave you a fear of being enclosed, and it probably had absolutely nothing to do with elevators at all. Then if you could understand that, you would be able to go into elevators fine. That phobia would have disappeared. So similarly, now that I understood that part of what was driving me to study medieval culture and Christianity was an ambivalent relationship to my own Jewish identity, the interest in continuing that study simply disappeared. Luckily, this happened slowly enough to allow me to bring to completion the book I had begun on medieval women and at least part of the study on the contemporary monastic communities that I had projected. I finished the study of the story of the foundation, but not the study of the ongoing relationships between the men and women. I'm now in the process, in fact, of doing the language training and reading that I will need in order to do research in the field which I now find myself drawn to, and that is modern Jewish history. I thus have come around to a relationship to my research in which I am connected by the direct identifying tie not only of gender, which I anticipate will continue to be a strong focus of my research, but now also with the direct tie of my Jewishness. And that, when I considered, well, if I want to go into Jewish history, can I at least get interested in medieval Jewish history? Because after all, I have all this training as a medievalist. I could still use that. I would just be shifting focus a little bit. And yet that just was not interesting to me. It's clearly what I'm going for now is the issues of identification and assimilation that are at stake in the modern period of Judaism, not so much in the medieval. Medieval period in Jewish history is kind of like a holding pattern between the ancient world, the crisis of the ancient world, and the crisis of the modern world, and it was one of those two crisis periods that I found myself drawn to. Now, this move to the explicit study of religion per se and to the study of Judaism in particular feels very right to me. Although the process of making such a major shift in fields is scary, I am also gratified by the pleasure I get from work that is related to deep personal concerns and by the pleasure I bring to others as I embark on this new path so that the modern Jewish history course, which I've just taught this term, seems to have been a success for the students as well as for myself. I'd like to close by making explicit a point that underlies this talk. I think it is important, healthy, useful, and productive to, in fact, choose one's area of research according to personal concerns. It's important for the individual doing research because one gets the opportunity to work out issues in one's own life. that is, by studying the interaction of medieval men and women, I came to a better understanding of male-female interaction in the modern world, and indeed in my own life. And by studying Christianity, I came indirectly to a better understanding of my own identity as a Jew. I'll be talking to the visionaries class this afternoon about how studying the life of a 12th century mystic has helped me understand friendship relations in general between men and women. So through connecting your personal concerns with the research, you can answer questions for yourself. But the research, too, I think, is better off for being done by someone who has a personal investment in the subject, because the research is then fueled in a powerful way to not only proceed, but proceed with the kind of energy and insight that will inspire those who read the results. In fact, I would hazard the assertion that it would be impossible for someone to be very productive in research without this kind of personal investment. It took me, and I was not atypical, I think, it took me 3 years of full-time work to complete my dissertation, another 5 years to complete the book that was based on that dissertation. It's very hard to keep going over that long period of time unless there's some kind of energy back there. You may not be aware, as I was not aware, I think, fully of what the nature of that energy was, but there needs to be something there. To just pick a topic because somebody else says it's important is not going to get you very far. You may be able to force yourself to write a term paper on it, but probably not much else. And you won't have much fun doing the term paper. Never let somebody else pick your topic for you. On a big paper, an exam you may be forced. Now, one is not always aware of what that personal investment is. As I said, as I was unaware of the influence of my being Jewish on my choice of medieval culture and Christianity. But my hope for this presentation today is that not only may I have interested you in my story for 15 minutes, but that I may also spur you to think about your own story and to have questions about what kind of research is fueled by what kinds of concerns, as well as talking to you about my story, to think about your story, why what you study interests you, and how your studies can help you pursue issues in your own life. Thank you.
What we have discovered as women in community here in Lincoln is what a joy it is to hear our own stories. And I think that Penny has reinforced that with our interaction with our professional lives as well. We can open this up for questions now. We have about 5 minutes for questions. So anyone want to ask a question?
Yeah, I think when I was young, I had less of the problem than, well, young as a child, I had less of a problem than when I was a growing adult, I would say, in college and university.
Yeah, but that's what I
mean. Okay. That's me, my young, okay. What's perspective changes over the years? Why was I able to confront that? Part of it, I think, is because of the... It may be different if I were growing up now and going to college and university now. I sense that the role, the kind of accepted role of religions in one's life is different now in the college scene than when it was when I was growing up. For example, I serve on a panel that screens Mellon Fellowships, applications for very prestigious awards for graduate school in the humanities, and interviewed 30 very bright undergraduates in February. And I was struck that of those 30, I would say about half of them were self-consciously pursuing religious topics or topics that they were self-consciously connected with some kind of personal religious motivation. I just don't think that would have been the case 20 years ago. I don't think they would have been encouraged in that regard. I don't think they would have felt free to express that. So that I think I was part of a larger phenomenon of a real secular aura to education at that time. So even though at the University of Chicago, where I said there were many Jews prominently on the faculty and the student body, I would guess was maybe 30% Jewish, which was certainly larger than I had experienced growing up. My high school, for example, there were in a class of 300, maybe 5 Jewish students. That somehow that fact of a large Jewish community had no effect on my own identification as a Jew. That was something I felt was to be left behind as part of my growing up process and part of my breaking away from my parents. And it's really only been much later in my adult life, and I think I feel almost embarrassed about how typical this is, but there are many people in their late 30s and early 40s, like me, who experience a kind of reconsideration of their religious roots. And I feel that's what I'm part of. It's also interesting to me how important institutional connections can be in one sense of religious identity in a way that I was not self-consciously aware of at that time. But as I thought about my talk, in fact, pointing out those institutions that I had been connected with as a child that did give me this ongoing concrete identification as a Jew that were simply let go of in college and graduate school. So there were things like a Hillel Club, which is a student group for Jews on many campuses. There was a Hillel Club at University of Chicago, I'm sure, but I never went to it. There were religious services provided. I went to one my freshman year in October of my freshman year, and then never went back. And so there was, other than the fact that I had Jewish friends, and I did, but that was never, that seemed more like accident than a positive identification, and none of us did participate in institutional ways with religion. And my own, the new importance of Jewish identity is not only reflected in my research, but for me now is reflected with an institutional commitment to the synagogue that is in Galesburg, for example, and to helping out the Hillel Club at Knox and things like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Worlds and research and interests mm-hmm. and so forth. At the point early on that you made that conscious decision, did you consider yourself to be different or unique, or did you feel that this was contrary to the mainstream? And do you have any reasons that you may have made this decision?
Mm-hmm. That was very much connected with my identity with the women's movement. So that, all right, this was a decision I made in the course of my first year in graduate school, which was 69-70. I was, consciously, thinking about what direction I might go in my own research, and I even had two very preliminary areas of dissertation interest that were appealing to me at the time. One was medieval notions of time and the past, which still is a fascinating topic to me. And the other was something about the problematic images of women in the Middle Ages. And in the political environment that I was in, and in the spring of 1970 at Stanford, that meant constant demonstrations, particularly about Stanford's involvement in the Vietnam War effort, and so that classes were called off for weeks at a time, and people were kind of in groups talking about politics and one's life and how one should be committed. For me, besides being against the war, it also enhanced involvement with the women's movement and a self-conscious decision that if I was going to spend my life as an academic, and that if these personal concerns as a woman and a feminist were important to me, I was going to have to unite them to keep myself from being some kind of schizophrenic, that I didn't want a life where I was just sitting in my study, concentrating on medieval notions of the past, from 8 to 5 or whatever, and then coming home and going to political demonstrations in the evening, that I wanted to have those identities united. Now, it was that conscious choice, I would say, was antithetical to certain positions in the profession about how one must be objective, and the last thing you would want to do is self-consciously identify your personal concerns with your research choice, that is just exposing yourself as hopelessly biased. Who would want to do that? So there certainly was at that time, and still is very much that strain within history. But particularly because of the community of feminists and other women's studies scholars, there was also a strong group of people in the margin, but a group nonetheless who I was happy to identify who felt that was not the case. In fact, one should unite personal concerns and one's life as a whole. In fact, that's kind of a theme of the modern women's movement in general, that there is, in fact, no distinction between one's personal life and what you do in your, quote, public life, that those things are very much connected. And I think even not only in the feminist movement, but I would say in the last 10 years or so in scholarship, there are in philosophy and history, many disciplines, increasing criticism of notions of objectivity and increasing interest in identifying the position from which the observer comes, whatever field that observer may be in. And you can't always know it for yourself. I mean, if you had asked me in 1972 what relationship my being Jewish had to do with my dissertation choice, I would simply have said to you nothing. It was irrelevant. Being Jewish seemed to me irrelevant at that point in my life. So it's only looking back on it that I can see that, in fact, there was some kind of connection, although indirect.
Today on University Forum, we've heard Penny Gold, professor of history at Knox College, Galesburg, Illinois. She spoke on A Jewish Feminist Studies Christian Monasticism. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.